They camped that night near a river. Cole didn't know which one, and ate, remaining silent as they had since leaving Doolittle's. Jimmy looked across the campfire, the flames dancing in his eyes.
You ever been into no man's land?
I've been there a time or two.
Then you know we won't find anyone to help us up in that country.
Yeah, I know.
Still, some decent folks live there, but they won't say anything if those boys haven't molested them.
Joe Digger spilled some whiskey in his cup and offered it around.
Anybody else?
No, thanks.
Well, I'll take a pull.
Cole accepted, then handed it back with a warning look. Digger's hooded gaze told Cole he hadn't forgotten their agreement.
Just a little something to keep the chill out.
Cole could see in the Indian's eyes that his mind was full of Anna, the way he stared into that fire as though trying to see the future dancing in the flames. Cole rolled himself a shuck and thought about Anna too, and wondered what she had wanted to tell him. He smoked and watched the fire burn down and tried not to think so much about his sins, but it was hard not to.
Oh, look at them stars falling.
Cole looked up, and sure enough, the stars were falling. One every few seconds. Jimmy looked up too, then after a moment lowered his gaze back to the fire.
Bad thing when the stars fall.
Joe Digger looked at him hard, the corner of his mouth twitching.
Leave off with that Injun talk.
You don't believe it?
Digger jerked his pistol.
No, I don't. I believe in this. I believe you put a bullet in a man, he stops breathing. I believe you offer a whore enough money, she'll go with you. I believe sour mash is the best whiskey there is going, but I don't believe stars falling out of the sky mean the damn thing.
Even so, you could tell Digger was uneasy with such talk, and he slopped some more whiskey down his gullet as he looked back up at the falling stars. You could see it in his face. He wasn't any more sure of the unknown than the rest of them. Anna had a dream the first night they were gone, in which she saw them lying in black coffins with glass tops, and that below the glass, their faces were in serene repose. Jimmy lay in the middle, with John Henry Cole to his right and Joe Digger to his left. Their hair was combed back and their mustaches waxed. The mourners, instead of being dressed in black, were dressed in bright colors, reds and blues and yellows. And instead of being a mournful time, there was a great celebration. The men were chasing the women around and around, being lewd with one another, and she couldn't understand it, and woke with a start, her heart hammering in her chest.
My God.
She rose from the bed and went to the window and looked out to see if their horses were there in the corral. Moonlight filled the yard in a pale swath, and the corral stood empty except for the small Palomino mare Jimmy had left her. The mare stood sleeping. Anna looked up and saw the stars falling. She felt a hand on her back and turned, but no one was there. The world seemed to tilt, and she felt herself going off the edge into the abyss.
Thomas?
Then she felt her world spin away, and the dream returned time and time again that night, full of laughter and dead men and the cries of a child. Her name was Hester Price, and she'd once lived in Dark County, Ohio, and had been girlhood friends with Phoebe Ann Moses, who was making a name for herself as Annie Oakley, a trick shot with Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. But that was a long time ago, and back when Phoebe Ann was just like every other girl except in one way, she was determined not to live and die in obscurity in Dark County. And she could shoot a rifle better than any man. Hester had felt much the same about living and dying in obscurity, but a girl had few options in that rather somber country. She could content herself with marrying one of the local boys, and thereby enter a life of raising crops and children, attending quilting bees and church socials, all the while trying and trying to survive childbearing, cholera, diphtheria, and boredom. Or a more ambitious and adventurous young woman could head into the Wild West, where word had it that even a homely woman could do well for herself among the vast hordes of lonely and desperate men who'd gone to seek their fortunes in the gold fields and silver mines. For Hester, there was little decision to be made. She went west. She met a man named Arkansas Ed, who turned out to be a pimp and a gambler, and not very good at either. But he was handsome, and a handsome man was her constant weakness. Somewhere amid the flurry of their romance, Arkansas Ed introduced her to the world of opium dens and the vices of dope. But bad as it would sometimes get, she told herself it was still a lot more interesting than lonesome, cicada-filled nights in Dark County, Ohio. Vastly better than muffled talk among the men about the weather and plowing and harvesting, and certainly more stimulating than standing with women in the kitchen talking about the men. Then Arkansas Ed got himself stabbed in a card game over a $5 pot in Tulsa, and that's where she ended up working to survive, as a crib girl, until Mr. St. John came along and made her a better offer. Mr. St. John was a hollow-eyed, slightly emaciated man, but dashingly handsome, with his neatly trimmed mustache and fine clothes, and he was as charming as 10 devils. Mr. St. John took her to dinner at the finest restaurant in Tulsa and introduced her to his companion, a younger woman named Lottie, to whom Mr. St. John referred often as Pleasure. Then sometime during the course of the evening, which ended up with the three of them back at Mr. St. John's hotel room, he took to calling Hester Delight. It was there, in the room, that he also inquired if the ladies would like to work for him. At first she laughed, just as Lottie had, just as they all had. But somewhere in the night, after so many bottles of champagne and several cocaine pills, she'd found herself in bed with them, and it wasn't a complete surprise to her, for they had surpassed the point of sanity and ended up falling asleep in one another's arms. And in the morning, Mr. St. John had taken them to breakfast and afterward bought each of them 2 new dresses and asked them to join him in a new venture. Hester had inwardly denied herself because her experience with handsome, charming men thus far had proved her misfortune. Mr. St. John was a smoother talker than Arkansas Ed.
What do you both have to lose except the dust of Tulsa and the stigma of being a crib girl?
I'm not so sure.
I would make each of you equal partners, and all monies from our endeavor would be split 3 ways.
I'm not so sure about this business.
He raised his eyebrows and smiled slyly.
There's only one business that men and women do here on the frontier that is worth a spit and a nickel. But I can assure you it is a good deal better than what you lovelies have been doing, and I won't abuse you. I will look out for you and won't allow anyone else to abuse you. I have a little crossroads enterprise 2 days right out of Tulsa, a sort of saloon, general store, and whorehouse combined. The business has suffered since the loss of my last 2 girls.
What happened to them?
Pleasure was a strawberry blonde with a dime-sized mole on her left cheek and large, innocent eyes, and her skin was nearly translucent. Her innocent manner and beauty made her easy to like.
Why, one got married, and the other saved her money and went off to college in Boston. It happens. I find myself about once a year in need of a new girl or two, and I knew the minute I laid eyes on you two, you were the ones. How about it?
She had little money, and though her dream had been someday to go to California, it may as well have been to go to China. Pleasure, nay Lottie Berg, had immediately accepted Mr. St. John's offer.
I have always been a sucker for a man with flattering lips and loose purse strings.
It's still whoring, ain't it?
It is, but tell me this, my sweet girl. What in this cruel and untamed world ain't?
The three of them rode to Greasy Junction and took up residence in the rear apartment of his establishment. It wasn't exactly California, but it was a far cry from the cribs of Tulsa and the boredom of Dark County, Ohio. Mr. St. John had stuck to his word and had divvied up the whoring money and had protected them from drunks and unruly buffalo hunters. He had also fed them well, always cooking the meals himself, and pampered them with kind words and gestures, and washed their backs in his big zinc tub that he pulled out every Wednesday and Friday night and filled with hot water. He insisted they bathe at least twice weekly, more if they so chose. He loved books and had a whole wall lined with shelves that held every manner of book on every subject imaginable. Yet he always carried a small red book with him.
What book is that, John?
It's a book of poetry by a fella named Keats. They say he's pretty good, and when I learn to read, I'm gonna read this book first.
I could read it to you.
No, thank you, dear.
It all seemed rather odd and exotic in some ways, living with Mr. St. John and Pleasure. They were like a small family that the greater world had abandoned, a family that had to survive on its own without the benefit of kindness from others. And though men came and went in the constant pursuit of their earthly pleasures, and paid well for it, Hester felt unaffected by their passing. At times, when there were no patrons lingering about and it was simply the three of them, Mr. St. John would sit in his rocker before the fire with the red book open on his lap, and his eyes would move over the words while Lottie brushed her hair. And Hester would find herself wishing him the ability to read the words aloud, knowing that the words would bring comfort to them all. And she knew that she had fallen in love with him, just as deeply as pleasure had. Their love became like a circle, and for Hester, the circle would always protect them from the outer harshness that lay beyond the timbered walls and the crossroads that led down from Tulsa and out toward Tahlequah and other unknown places. Then, in the midst of her newfound happiness, the riders came. Jimmy Wildbird, John Henry Cole, and Joe Digger rode for 4 days into the West, each day riding until the sun stood low on the horizon and threw its blinding light into their eyes. On the fourth night, Joe Digger's pack horse got into some gypsum weed and ran off, and they had to trail it the next morning into a box canyon where they found it, or what remained of it. Someone had butchered the animal, taking the haunches, heart, and liver, and leaving the rest to the buzzards that flew off with great flapping wings as they approached.
Damn and Jesus! Somebody's done carved up my pack horse!
Poor Indians. They found that horse and carved him up into meat.
How'd you know it was poor Indians?
What else but a poor starving person would kill a horse for meat? Let's go.
I can't just let this here crime go unpunished. That was a damn good pack horse up till now.
What do you aim to do? Go find them starving Indians and make them puke up your horse?
Digger looked forlorn. Jimmy looked at the wheel of buzzards against the bright blue sky, the sun catching in their dark wings. On the return to camp, they came across a black man in a big painted wagon hauled by a matching pair of mules. The mules were big jacks whose ears flicked and hides rippled along their ribs.
How do's, gentlemen?
Digger looked at the man.
We're looking for 5 men. You seen any riders that add up to 5?
The black man shook his head.
Just seen 1 man. That was a few days ago. And he was walking.
White man or Indian?
Oh, neither. He was a Spanish. Vaquero.
That ain't one of them, then.
This Spanish. You say he was walking?
Yes, sir.
Where was he walking to?
He didn't say. Said some men had killed his wife, and he's going after him. He didn't even have a gun. I traded him one for this here silver cross.
The man reached in the top of his shirt and showed them a silver cross threaded on a string of leather.
Which way do you run into the fellow?
Jimmy's lawman's brain was at work, calculating, putting things together. So was Cole's. It's a habit you learn if you wear a badge long enough. Little things come to big things sometimes.
Back yonder.
The black man thumbed over his shoulder.
No man's land. Sounds like those boys ain't through killing yet.
Well?
You armed?
I got a sawed-off shotgun under the seat.
Keep it handy.
I always do.
Best to stay alert.
He nodded, and Cole rode after the others. 3 days later, they came to the burned-out cabin.
Looks like a grave over here. See how the ground's sunken in?
Just one.
The Spanish's woman.
Looks like.
A man on foot. What chance in hell does he have?
I wouldn't count this one out. I know this old man. His name is Pablo Juarez. And rumor has it he was a killer down along the Mexican border years ago.
Shit. Old man afoot, I don't care if he was 3 killers down along the border.
Jimmy Wildbird had a look in his eyes. A strange, far-off look.
They'll murder lots before we catch them.
Digger rode around the camp in ever-increasing circles, leaning off to the side of his saddle. Then he rode back to where Jimmy and Cole sat their horses.
They ain't heading west no more. Tracks lead off that way.
He pointed in a southeasterly direction.
What's that way, Jimmy?
Closest place is Greasy Junction.
What's there?
Nothing much, just a whiskey den and a whorehouse.
If they get there before we do, then...
Yeah.
Jimmy nodded his head and tapped the ends of the reins in his palm. He was still looking off in the direction Digger had indicated.
Might be a way we can get there first.
How's that? Have our horses grow wings? They got at least a 4 or 5 day lead.
You look at them tracks close.
Sure I looked at them close.
They look like they were riding hard?
Digger shook his head.
That's because they're in no hurry. They don't think anyone would be fool enough to follow them. They're taking their time, killing as they go. We ride cross country, we might get there before they do. Be waiting on them.
Well, hell's bells. What are we waiting on?
We'll have to leave the pack animals to ride hard.
Leave them.
Jimmy put heels to his horse. Digger looked at Cole.
I already left mine, back up in that box canyon.
Cole had little choice but to ride after them.
Only fools rush in. Maybe that's what we are. Fools.
Pablo Juarez had himself a fine horse and saddle and repeating rifle with plenty of bullets. But none of these could he eat, and game proved to be scarce, but with a single sighting of some antelope far out of rifle range. It had been 3 days since he had robbed the man of his gun and horse.
Maybe I should have stolen his dinner also, eh, horse?
The horse tossed its head and stepped lively to the command of Pablo's knees and legs. The sky to the south was growing fat with gray and black clouds. A storm was building. Pablo could feel the storm gathering in his bones, the ache traveling the length of his back and into his hands.
Oh, maybe I should have stolen a blanket, too.
Pretty soon he saw a house sitting not far off the road and rode over to it. When he came close enough, he saw the woman bent to work in a large garden, where the corn stood taller than she, its green leaves shimmering in the sun. He could see, too, that she had some beans and squash planted. He sat his horse for a long time and watched her, and if she saw him, she made no sign that she did, for she stayed bent to her work the whole while, moving slowly along the rows, her hoe rising and falling, chopping weeds. Rising and falling, and it seemed he could feel the blistery heat of the wood handle in his own palms. He touched his heels to the horse's ribs and rode it forward until she stood and turned and looked at him, the hoe raised, ready to chop another patch of weeds from the unforgiving earth.
Hola, amiga!
She was maybe as old as he, her face the color of tarnished copper. Her hair was long and black and twisted in a ponytail that hung down her back like a frayed rope, and she wore a straw hat not unlike his own. She looked at him with unflinching eyes. She didn't say anything at first. He removed his hat and wiped his forehead with the back of his wrist, realizing he must have presented a rough appearance to her.
I am Señor Juarez.
He made an effort to smile to let her know he was just a simple man that didn't want to visit any harm on her.
What do you want here, mister?
I have not eaten in 3 days.
She looked him over pretty well.
You are skinny.
He nodded and looked down at himself.
I have to agree with you. I look like an old sack of bones.
You Mexican?
He nodded.
I'm part Mexican. Part Apache. My old husband was Osage. He ran off 2-3 years ago. Had a drinking fever and ran off with a young Cherokee girl who had a club foot. Never did come back. If he ever come back here, I'll shoot him. He was never no good anyhow. I'm glad he ran off. You wanna get down?
Yes.
My name's Rosemary.
That's a good name.
You want to eat some squash with me?
Yes, I'd like to eat some squash.
My corn ain't ready yet.
Es bueno.
I got a little meat, some salted pork.
No, squash will be fine.
He sat under a little ramada there in the shade and drank some tizwin she offered him. He'd drunk the Apache beer before, down along the border. It was bitter, but slaked his thirst. The woman kept it cooled in ollas hanging there under the ramada. They ate the squash and 3 or 4 of the fry bread she made and washed it down with some more of the tizwin.
What you doing clear out here?
I'm looking for some men.
Why are you looking for them?
They killed my wife.
Ooh, that's too bad. You looking for a new wife, too?
No, I guess I'm not. Not too many women would put up with me. I got some bad ways.
I got my bad ways, too.
He nodded. She looked him over.
How many are these men you're looking for?
5.
She squinted over the pipe smoke.
Too many for just one man.
Maybe not.
You're kinda old, eh?
He shrugged.
What if you catch them and they kill you?
Then I guess that will be the end of it for me.
You ought not to go after them.
I think it is going to rain soon.
I think so too.
She looked up at the sky, then back at him. The warm sun ahead of the storm, along with the tizwin, had made him drowsy.
How do you make it here alone, since your husband ran off and left you? This looks like some pretty poor ground.
I can raise enough in my garden, long as I keep at the weeds. I have a few chickens. I used to have a cow, but she went dry and wouldn't give me no more milk, so I sold her.
Why didn't you just butcher and eat her?
Oh, I had that cow a long time. I don't guess I could just eat her. I wish I still had her. She was a good cow.
I know. You have something with you a long time, and then when it's gone, you miss it.
Yes.
He felt the weariness of a long journey and a full belly, and the opiate of the tizwin settle into his marrow. He closed his eyes and felt the warm air being swept along before the coming storm.
You're pretty wore out, huh?
He opened his eyes.
Yes, I've ridden a long way.
You want to sleep a little?
Sometimes when I sleep, I dream of my wife.
Hmm. I don't never dream of my old husband. But sometimes I dream of young men coming to my bed.
He looked at her, saw the devilment in her eyes.
I don't have any money to pay you for the meal.
Who asked you to pay, eh?
I would like to pay you for your kindness.
Ah, squash don't cost hardly nothing.
In the distance, they could see the amassing thunderheads.
You better go sleep in the house.
Maybe I'll sleep for just a little while. Just until the storm passes.
Sure, you better do that.
He was grateful to her, more than he could say. She had the same kindness as his Maria. She showed him a place where he could lie down inside the house. It was a pallet on the floor in a small room off the kitchen.
This is where my old husband would sleep when we weren't getting along too good. He slept there a lot.
The first drops of rain clicked against the window as he lay down upon the pallet. It felt good being here, at rest, the rain dancing against the window above his head, its rhythm lulling him to sleep, the tiswin easing the dull ache in his bones. He must have slept a long time, because when he awakened, the storm had passed and the sky was a dusty rose color, and beyond the setting sun, the storm clouds glowed silver. It took him a moment to gather his wits about him and remember where he was. He found the woman sitting outside in the rain-washed air, smoking her pipe.
Hola.
The storm knocked down all my corn.
He looked toward the garden. The stalks were lying over, their long waxy leaves in puddles of water.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Me too.
He suddenly felt angry, his head full of angry thoughts against God. Why was kindness always repaid with unkindness? Why did the men kill his wife after he'd offered them kindness? Why did the storm ruin this poor woman's corn? Maybe it was he that God was angry at for all those times when he was a bandit. Maybe that was what it was. God was paying him back for his sins. But why take it out on his wife and this woman simply because of their kindness toward him? He walked over and looked more closely at the broken stalks.
It won't do no good to look at them.
I just wanted to see.
Go ahead and look then.
I didn't even hear it, the storm.
You were sleeping pretty good, snoring. It was a pretty bad storm. I thought maybe it'd take the roof off. But the roof didn't go nowhere. Just the corn.
He felt ashamed for having slept through the storm.
I still got some seed left. In the morning, I'll plant the corn again.
He turned and looked at her. She seemed undisturbed by her loss.
It doesn't bother you? Losing your corn?
Well, nothing I can do about it except plant some more. What else can I do?
I don't know.
You see, it's like that sometimes. Things happen that you can't do nothing about. You just have to live with it.
I will stay and help you plant the corn again.
I thought you were looking to find those men who killed your wife.
I still am, but another day won't make any difference. I don't even know where to look for them.
It's a pretty big place, this country. I don't know how you're going to find a few men in such a big place.
I don't know either.
You don't have to stay. I can plant the corn myself. I did it alone the last time.
I will stay and help you.
It's all right with me if you want to stay.
He didn't know any other way of repaying her kindness to him. He would still have plenty of time to find the men who killed his wife. What would one more day matter?
I'll fix a little meat and some bread for supper.
He could see the sun now descending beyond the woods, blood red against the black, wet trunks of the trees. Later, they sat and ate the meat and some bread the old woman had fixed for their supper. The woman stopped eating just then.
What?
If you hear the owl call your name, it means you'll die soon.
Yes, I've heard that too.
Do you believe it?
I don't know. My wife used to tell me things like that, but I didn't know what to believe about them.
There's some truth to what the Indian peoples know, but some of it is just talk.
I know.
After a while, she began to eat again, her eyes fixed to some uncertainty in her mind.
You are a good cook.
I bet my old husband misses it. He liked to eat and was big and fat. I hope that skinny girl he ran off with don't know how to cook. It'll make him sorry he ran off from me.
Her laugh made him to smile.
It will serve him right if he was hungry.
Oh, I miss my people sometimes.
Where are they?
Most of them went to Mexico after the army chased them out of Arizona. They didn't have no choice but to go down there. I guess later some of them got to come back, but I think they were put on the reservation, someplace called San Carlos.
Why don't you go back, if you miss them?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen any of them. You know how it is. Maybe if I went to find them, it wouldn't be the same like it was, like I remember. I like it here. But I might like it there, too, if I was to go back. I think about it sometimes.
Well, you could go and see how it is, and then if you liked it, you could stay there with your people. Wouldn't that be better than being here alone?
She shrugged.
Maybe.
He recognized the look of longing that swam in her eyes. He'd felt it too, the wanting to go back to a time and place that was better than where he now found himself. Maybe someday he would. Maybe someday they both would. But for now, he would help her replant the corn, and then he would go look for the man who killed his wife.
You want some more meat?
Sure.
There were two women and a fancily dressed man who was reading a small red book, and they'd all looked up. Red Snake could see right away in their eyes. They knew this was no ordinary business that was about to be conducted. He and his four companions had arrived in the dark. They could see the lights of the building from a good distance, and it felt a welcoming sight, as it always did when he was hungry and riding half the night, to see lights in the dark. They had dismounted and gone in to find the white man sitting in a chair, reading a book, with the two women sitting on the floor near his feet. The white man looked up and acted as though nothing was wrong, but the boy could see the caution in his eyes.
Welcome, gentlemen. Fancy a drink?
The white man stood up and walked behind the bar and poured them a whiskey.
Unfortunately, whiskey is all I can offer. The girls don't work on Sundays.
The boy found it amazing that he had lost track of even what day it was. But time seemed to mean more to white men than it did to Indians. The boy and the others walked to the bar, drank the man's liquor, and looked at the two women.
Maybe if you all were to come back tomorrow, we could do some business as far as the women are concerned.
Well, we got a lot of distance to cover, and me and the boys have already come a long distance out of the way to do some business tonight, not tomorrow.
The white man tried being clever about it, making his movements seem casual behind the bar while he poured more whiskey. Then Billy Starr walked up behind him and shot the man in the head, causing a splatter of blood and bone that flew into Caddo's face.
God damn it, Billy!
What'd you think? You were gonna talk that fool to death?
Billy looked down at his handiwork before reaching in the man's pocket and retrieving the red book. He stood there looking at the book for a moment before tossing it to the floor, and the boys saw that there were bloodstains on it that were darker red than the leather covers, and there was a small tongue of red ribbon hanging from its pages. Caddo wiped the white man's blood from his face with the back of his hand, looked at it, and then turned to Billy.
If you ever pull a trick like that again, we might have some real trouble between us, Billy.
Billy gave him a hard, challenging stare, but said nothing. The book on the floor reminded Red Snake of some early childhood memory that was unclear, but one he remembered that had to do with books. He picked it up and put it into his pocket when the others had turned their attention to the women. Later, when Red Snake stood watch near the corral, he took the book from his pocket and tilted the pages toward the wan light coming from the cabin's windows. And as his finger traced the lines of print, the book and the fragmented memory that the book raised, and the presence of horses and moonlight, stirred something in him that had been long missing. Then the wind came and spoke to him.
You are the child of a star that fell to earth in the form of a woman. The same blood that flows in you still flows in this woman, and in the man who found her after she'd fallen to earth.
Then it blew through the dark and passed in front of the moon before ruffling the pages of the book. The printed words were a mystery to Red Snake. A chill passed through him from front to back, like the passing of a steel blade through his body. Red Snake awakened to what he thought was a dream. But then he saw that the dream was real, that fog had crept in during the night and blanketed everything. He was cold and stiff from having spent the night there by the corral, sleeping with his back against a gnarled blackjack post. He was still unraveling himself from his dreams when one of the horses in the corral was answered by another, somewhere near the woods. He thought he saw movement in the mist. He hurried inside the cabin.
I heard something.
The others quickly grabbed up their rifles and pistols and took up positions by the windows. He saw the two women in the corner of the room, blankets wrapped around them, their eyes red and troubled. The younger of the two stared silently, while the other looked at him defiantly, and he felt her defiance burn the side of his face.
Hey, Red Snake! You and Jamal go out to the privy and take up positions there. If anyone rides in, we can catch him in a crossfire.
What? I'm not going out there.
Billy struck Jamoa July across the cheek with the barrel of his pistol, drawing blood. Jamoa and Red Snake headed for the privy. They reached the privy with Jamoa still touching his busted cheek, and they stood inside with the door partially ajar.
I'm just a goddamn same as him. I'm a goddamn Creek, and so is he. Where does he get the right, hitting me in the goddamn face like that?
They stood there, listening and smelling the stink that came up from the sit holes and mixed with the metallic fog.
You think somebody's out there, Snake?
Red Snake shrugged.
I don't know.
Has to be. It was just somebody riding through innocent. They'd have been here by now. Has to be the goddamn law, don't you think?
They came through the fog. Jimmy Wildbird checked his horse.
There it is.
The grayish outline of a building stood, ghostly and silent, perhaps 100 yards distant. And there was an uncanny quiet there in the woods where they set their horses.
You think we beat them here?
Hard to tell. The way this fog is, there could be horses down there. Maybe not.
We ride in or what?
It could. Or we could sit and wait for it to burn off.
The lawman looked at Cole.
What do you think?
I don't like going in blind.
The fog lay around them like wet smoke, and you could almost taste the air, wet and cool as it was. Jimmy pulled a fat pocket watch from his coat and snapped open the face.
7:15.
Maybe they're there. We'll kill them eating breakfast.
I don't want them killed.
You might not have no choice, Constable.
Cole shucked the Winchester from its boot and checked the breech, then rested it across the pommel.
I vote to wait. At least until we can get the lay of things.
Digger dismounted and tightened his cinch strap.
They could be waiting right inside. Or we might have gotten here first.
They'd ridden hard and with little rest, cutting across country, but it was no assurance that they'd reached Greasy Junction before the renegades. The trouble with hunting men was you never knew which way they were going to jump, because they never knew which way they were going to jump. So sitting there in the fog, waiting for the sun to rise high enough to burn things off, none of them could be certain their quarry was in the bush. Digger pulled a bottle of whiskey from his saddlebags.
Leave off with that.
Digger looked hard at Cole, defiantly took a quick pull, then slipped the bottle back into his saddlebags.
A man needs breakfast.
Jimmy also dismounted and was pouring water from his canteen into a cupped hand for his horse to drink when a horse nickered through the bank of fog and Jimmy's mount raised its head and answered.
If they're down there, they know we're here.
Then I say to hell with it. Let's ride down and find out.
Jimmy threw himself into leather.
Oh, hold on!
It was too late. Jimmy had put his heels to his horse and was gone through the fog.
What the hell?
Let's go!
Cole slapped the rump of his pony with the barrel of the Winchester. It was like riding into a nightmare. In the rush and confusion and fog, they got separated. It was as though the fog simply swallowed them up when they rode into it. You couldn't see more distance than a good spit in front of you. Cole came busting out of the woods and down the slight slope to where the cabin sat, just in time to catch a glimpse of the tail end of the two riders ahead of him. Then, as if commanded by some higher power, the fog cleared right there in front of the cabin, and Jimmy and Joe Digger appeared as if by magic. Cole could see there were horses in the corral, at least 7 horses by quick count, and some were still saddled.
Here they come!
The first gunshot buckled the front legs of Jimmy's horse, and for a moment he seemed suspended in mid-flight before hitting the ground in a tumble. Digger pulled his animal up short, but already too late as they opened up. A bullet tore away Cole's right stirrup, and he saw Digger twist hard in his saddle as if from a blow. Jimmy had regained his feet and was firing both his pistols at the cabin while trying to duck walk his way to a water trough to the west of the cabin. Cole slapped the reins against the withers of his mount, then saw Digger snatch from his saddle as though an invisible rope had snagged him. He landed hard, rolled over, and got to his hands and knees, coughing up blood. There was a lot of gunfire, and it wasn't all coming from the cabin. Cole saw a rifle barrel pointing from the door of the privy and fired a round through it, jacked the lever of the Winchester, and fired again. Wood splintered, and a body tumbled halfway out. Cole kicked his mount to reach Digger, who had gotten to one knee. He could see Digger had been shot in the arm and side. Blood drenched his shirt. Cole reached for Digger, bringing himself and his horse between Digger and the cabin. Cole held out his hand to pull Digger aboard when something hot drove into his leg. His horse jumped away, the bullet having gone through Cole's leg muscle and punched into the gelding's ribs, sending it into a panic. Digger fell flat trying to reach Cole's hand, righted himself. Then the top of his head exploded and his body arched as though struck by a lightning bolt before toppling backward. A bullet clipped Cole's hat and another struck the horn of his saddle. Cole jerked his self-cocker and rapid-fired at the cabin as he leaned low over his pony's neck and jumped the water trough. He could see Jimmy Wildbird's elbow blown out from around. Pieces of ivory bone and bloody torn flesh poked through his shirt sleeve. The arm hung limply at his side.
Climb up!
Cole reached for him as Jimmy shook his head.
They've killed us!
Not yet, they haven't. Climb up!
He reached his good arm for Cole, then a fusillade hit Cole's horse, toppling it over. Cole leaped free, tumbling along the ground, then scrabbled behind the trough where Jimmy now lay, staring at his shattered elbow. Bullets slapped the water above their heads and thunked into the boards of the trough.
Jesus Christ! Jesus Christ!
We'll make the woods!
What about Digger?
He's killed.
We'll die too. We tried crawling out from behind this trough.
We'll sure as hell die if we stay.
Cole saw the fear in his eyes, the doubt that every man has to face at one point or another in his life. Even in the best of them, Cole had seen that look. He'd had that look in his own eyes more than once. You tell yourself you're too young to die, that you're not ready, that it can't be happening to you. You tell yourself lots of things, but nothing works, and the fear rises up from your gut and the bile catches in your throat.
Get moving. I'll lay down a cover and fire.
Jimmy looked again at his elbow.
Move, goddammit!
The only thing that lay between them and the woods was an old tool shed. But they had the fog that was still dense away from the house. And if they could reach the shed, they could slither off into the fog, then the woods beyond. Cole shoved the self-cocker into his belt and took up the Winchester once again and began laying down rapid fire into the cabin. Jimmy broke cover, and Cole thought maybe they would make it. He turned in time to see Jimmy go down.
Get up, Jimmy!
Jimmy barely moved. Cole kept up the fire until the hammer fell on an empty chamber. He reloaded the self-cocker and took the hideout Colt from the shoulder rig. 12 chances to save them, 6 rounds of lead in each pistol. He fired all 12, then broke for Jimmy, grabbed him by the belt, and hauled him toward the tool shed. The bullets split the air like killer bees, but with every foot of ground Cole gained, their luck increased, and his heart was pumping blood so hard he barely felt the hole in his leg. They landed painfully on the hard ground behind the tool shed, but they had made it.
How bad you hit?
Jimmy rolled over. The bullet had caught him in the back, but low beneath the ribs.
I'm a damn fool.
Don't remind me.
The color had washed out of him.
We gotta make those woods.
Jimmy shook his head.
You go on, leave me.
You're not dead yet.
I will be.
Only if you stay here.
I ain't afraid of dying.
Well, I am. Now grab hold.
Cole picked him up and put him across his shoulders. The fire from the cabin had ceased, and Cole could see that the sun was getting high enough that it was beginning to burn off the rest of the fog. They had to make the woods, at least. There, they could make a last stand of it if they had to. Cole's leg was starting to hurt now as he carried Jimmy, and Cole could feel the blood filling up his boot. It was a warm, mushy feeling that quickly turned to a cold, mushy feeling as the blood leaked out. His leg grew colder and more painful, the blood taking vital heat with it. They finally made the tree line, and in a half dozen paces, Cole dropped to the ground and rolled Jimmy off his shoulders. Jimmy lay on his back, looking up through the trees at the fog-shrouded sun. Cole took off his bandana and plugged the hole in his thigh muscle with it. Then he took off Jimmy's bandana and tied it around his elbow, and Jimmy winced when he did it as if he'd been touched with a hot iron. Cole looked again at the puckered wound below Jimmy's ribs. Like Cole, he'd been lucky that the shot had gone clean through. Cole took off Jimmy's belt and strapped it around his upper waist, the tail of his dirty shirt being the only bandage there was, and he leaned back, trying hard to catch his breath. Jimmy lay there like a wounded animal and stared at the hazy sky.
You think they'll come?
They'd be fools to come walking up to these woods.
No, they wouldn't. Look at us. Shot to pieces. Shot up as sin.
We may have got a few of them as well. I dropped one in the privy.
Jimmy blinked the sweat out of his eyes.
Oh, I don't know what got into me. I just so goddamn bad wanted them. I didn't want them to get away.
Well, they sure as hell didn't get away.
Cole took out the makings and fashioned a cigarette and lit it. He offered it to Jimmy.
Tobacco and whiskey were never my vices.
Tell me, if I had a bottle of Digger's Tennessee whiskey right now, you wouldn't take a drink.
I'd drink every goddamn drop.
So would I.
Cole reloaded his pistols and the one Jimmy carried in a crossover holster, and then counted the number of shells they had left between them.
21 chances to live.
What now?
We wait.
Till they come?
Till they come or decide to get in the wind.
I can't feel my hand.
Cole looked at the shattered elbow, the bandana already soaked with blood, dark and red.
You able to shoot either hand?
Uh-huh.
Then I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Jimmy looked away, but Cole could see the bitterness in his eyes. The arm would never be any good to him anymore. It's hard to lose a piece of yourself and not feel bitter. It takes time for the reality of it to settle in. Even then, it never does completely. Jimmy looked at him.
It ain't so much that.
What then?
We didn't finish the job, is what it is. I'd lose an arm and a leg if I had to just to bring in those bastards.
Hell, I don't know so much about that.
Was you me, you'd understand.
Was I you, maybe so. But look at it this way. At least you've lived to fight those boys another day.
We need to finish it.
You suggesting we go back and let them have another crack at us?
No, not now.
I appreciate it. This is the seventh time I've been shot since I became a man. Not one time has it felt good. I don't feature carrying any more lead around in me.
We might both be dead by sunset.
They waited all that day and into the evening. Then they heard running horses.
You hear that?
They got in the wind.
Shit.
We'll get another chance at them.
How do you know?
Just a feeling, Jimmy. Just a real bad feeling.
For 5 days, Pablo stayed with the woman. He helped her plant corn and harvested some of the squash and checked the progress of the beans and peppers. At the end of each day, they sat and talked into the evenings and drank tiswin, and Rosemary smoked her pipe and asked Pablo questions about himself and told him about herself and her people. On the morning of the sixth day, he grew restless.
I am going.
Why don't you stay?
It would be easier, but I told you I have to go find those men and kill them.
Maybe you go and you don't ever find them. Then what?
Oh, I'll find them. I found lots of men like them when I was younger.
You were a pretty bad man in them days, huh?
Yes, I was a bad hombre.
Then that's it. You're gonna go off. You think maybe someday you'll come back up this way?
I don't know. Maybe those men will kill me. But if they don't, maybe I'll come back. I still have to take that horse back to the man I borrowed him from.
The sky looked bruised, and a cool wind blew down from the north. She watched him go out to the shed and begin to saddle his horse. She felt sorry for him, an old man like that riding around the country looking for men to kill. He should be sitting somewhere drinking coffee or a little liquor and telling lies about his life. She went in the house and fixed him a sack of food, some beef jerky and biscuits, and an olla of tiswin he could take along with him. She took a spare blanket from the bed and carried these things out to him.
Here, a little something to make your journey more comfortable.
He looked at her from across the seat of his saddle.
Do you want me to kill that husband of yours if I come across him?
Nah, don't waste no good bullets on someone like him.
Bueno.
He swung up into the saddle and adjusted his old hat, pulling up the stampede string tight under his chin.
I see him. I just scare him a little.
She held the reins of his horse until he looked down at her with that determined gaze she'd come to like.
Adios.
Maybe I'll see you sometime.
Si, maybe so.
She watched him turn the horse back up toward the road and then ride it at a canter like he and his horse were one creature.
You sure must have been something, mister, when you was a young man. Look at the way you sit up on that fine horse, so proud, like you own all the world. Like all the world is gonna know who you are when you come riding through. Well, I bet all the women were after you in them days when you was a young man. You ain't coming back, old man. Just like my old husband never came back. Men leave, they don't come back. Only I don't miss him for nothing. But I sure might miss you.
Pablo could feel the old woman's eyes on him as he rode away. He hated to leave her in a way, but his business wasn't finished. And until it was, he had no room in his heart for anyone or anything. She continued to watch until he had ridden out of sight.